This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. On this Thanksgiving Eve edition of our program, we're listening to portions of a conversation I had with David Shipler, author of the book The Working Poor, recorded in front of an audience at the Fayetteville Public Library last month. Several members of the audience asked him questions, including one about the value of helping those struggling near or below the poverty level, a value David Shipler says extends beyond those families immediately helped.
I think you're right about that, because I'll give you an example of how I think that plays out. I talked about housing and malnutrition and the effect on brain development. There have been some interesting longitudinal studies. It's going to take me a little while to get to your argument. I hope you'll bear with me. There have been some longitudinal studies of infants who suffered from iron deficiency during those critical periods of brain development. They went back to these kids, and then their nutrition was restored. They went back to these kids as adolescents and tested them. And they found, in fact, I may have, if I have this. Oh boy, sorry about that. If I have these results, I'll read them to you so that I don't get them wrong. And here they are. So they found that even after their nutrition was restored, these children who had suffered from iron deficiency during infancy scored lower in math, writing, motor functioning, spatial memory, and selective recall. They exhibited more anxiety, depression, social problems, and attention problems. So they didn't. Their mental abilities didn't recover. Now, if you have cognitive difficulties, I would guess, and I do not have any studies to cite, but I would guess logically that you have a higher probability of dropping out of school. I mean, my wife said to me when I was doing this, she used to be an elementary school teacher, ask kids when you go to schools what percentage of the time they don't understand what the teacher is saying. So I did, and I got some startling answers. 40% of the time, 50%, 60%. So I would say, well, what do you do about that? Well, Mrs. Black is okay. You know, she'll give us, you know, she'll explain things. But Mr. Gray just gets mad at us for not paying attention. Now, I think if you have to sit for hours a day not understanding half of what goes on in a class, you're probably not going to stay there if you can get out of it. And when people drop out of high school, the most recent figures I've seen, show that they earn an average of $26,000 less a year, pay $60,000 less in taxes over their lifetimes, and have health conditions at age 45 equivalent to the health of an average 65-year-old high school graduate. If you look at the U.S. Department of Education's National Assessment of Adult Literacy, which is done every 10 years, in which a large sample of adults is given little tasks to do, the results are really scary, and I have these too, which I'll give to you. The last time it was done was 2003, so we're coming up to another time. And what it showed that was that 55% could not look at a catalog of office supplies, pick out certain items to order, and add up the total cost. 55%. 55% could not read the label on a bottle of prescription medicine and understand when to take the medicine in relation to meals. 55%. 43% could not read a job wanted ad and summarize the work experience that was required for the job. 43%. 34% could not follow directions on a map. Now, with GPS, we're going to all lose that skill, I suppose. But still, I mean, it's. And 22%, being told an hourly wage, could not add it up to come to the total of a weekly wage. Now, if this is accurate, and I have no, I mean, and by the way, it's given in Spanish as well, and the non-Spanish, non-English speakers who were surveyed were such a tiny fraction of the sample that the difference, you know, by on the basis of language was probably insignificant. Now, if this is accurate, It means that the labor force in the United States is not competitive in a global marketplace, which is ruthless. Business leaders, business owners say they can't find skilled workers. I wrote about one fellow in Cleveland who's the third generation of a family that owns a manufacturing company that makes hydraulic hoses, and he wanted to expand. This was some years ago, and couldn't. After the book came out, I met in Baltimore the owner of a trucking company who said he needed more diesel mechanics and truck drivers and couldn't find them. I said, "Will you train them?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "What do you pay?" He said, $21-$22 an hour." Now, Baltimore has a high unemployment rate, so there's probably a problem there of just sort of connecting the business needs with the unemployed, but there also may be a problem, and I'll bet there is, among many unemployed in Baltimore of low skills, reading problems, math problems, which you do, you need those skills certainly to be a diesel mechanic. And it's not so easy to get a truck driving license. You got to take tests and stuff. So I think that you're absolutely right when you suggest that helping address the problems of poverty is not just pure altruism. There's a self-interested part of that, very much so.
Young woman here had not finished the book yet, so she was wondering if there were any solutions at the end or if there was going to be another book.
I wrote the book and I didn't have, there is a final chapter with some broad ideas for addressing the problems. When I wrote the book, I didn't have that last chapter in it at first. I felt it needed, I'm a reporter basically, I'm not a policy wonk, I'm not an economist, I'm not really well versed in the way the financial private sector works, and so I was hesitant to wade into the prescription writing process. So I sent the manuscript to my editor at Knopf, and I don't usually do this, I usually wait till I'm really done and it's really in as good a condition as I think I can get it, and then I send it to him. But this time I sent it to him, and I said, what do you think? Do I need a last chapter on solutions? Because I kind of think I do, but it gets me into territory I'm not 100% comfortable with, to be honest. And he said, yeah, it does need it. It begs for that. So the last chapter does have some broad ideas about, my basic argument that I make that probably not, hasn't been made very widely. I mean, a lot of the solutions, so-called solutions or possible ways of alleviating the problem are pretty obvious. Higher earned income tax credit payments, more food stamp coverage, broader Medicaid, which of course the Affordable Care Act will provide if the states agree to accept it. More housing subsidies and that sort of thing, higher minimum wage perhaps. But beyond that, I think we need gateways through which poor families can pass into multiple services. So that, for example, there's a food bank in Washington, D.C. called Bread for the City. And when someone comes in to get food, the person goes through an intake and is asked lots of questions about medical care, about whether they're actually signed up for Medicaid if they're eligible, whether they're having a housing issue, and so forth. For a lot of time, I don't know right now whether they have a lawyer there, but they often have had an attorney right there in that food bank office, paid for by a separate grant, who can help people with housing problems. And the pediatrics department at the Boston Medical Center discovered that to deal with asthma, children's asthma, they had to hire lawyers to call the landlords. Pediatricians calling the landlords didn't do any good. So they now have five lawyers at the pediatrics department of the Boston Medical Center. And there are almost 200 medical legal partnerships around the country that have followed this model. Because doctors are understanding that environmental problems can exacerbate disease. So they have the food bank has a medical clinic next door. So there's a whole way of seeing the interaction. If you see the interactions among the problems, then the solutions kind of follow naturally. if you can find the services and guide people to them so that they can, when they come presenting one problem, they get some action on a range of problems. And that's very expensive. And that costs a lot of money. I mean, schools could be our ideal gateways. I mean, teachers see kids coming in from, you know, with terrible problems, but there's not a lot the teachers can do in most school systems. Police departments. I just heard that the sheriff's department here has a person assigned to try to get recovering addicts who've been through rehab, through the drug court, jobs. So there's kind of a job placement person in the sheriff's department. That's a very smart idea. That kind of combining of, you know, taking people who come to a particular place and providing something beyond what that place is designed to give is the, I think, a very important approach.
Yes, ma'am. The comment was she hopes that we can figure some things out, but she's concerned that the poor will always be with us, remembering Lyndon Baines Johnson's war on poverty.
Yeah, which we lost, I guess, right?
We lose everything that we call domestically a war.
I think that's a fair comment. That is, you know, I think it's not realistic to imagine that there will never, ever be any people in poverty, no matter how assiduously we apply our knowledge and skills to the problem and our resources, because it costs money. There are people who are have mental problems, mentally ill, who have substance abuse problems, who are physically disabled, and you know, for lots of other situations, which really prevent them from seeing their skills rise to the level in which they can get work that will pay adequately. I do think, though, that between that group and the poverty level now, which is 15.2%, there's a lot of possibility. And I can't give you statistics to prove it, but just in my experience of spending time with families, people who are very hardworking, but who thought of themselves as lazy, by the way. I mean, there's a syndrome of kind of internalizing the judgments of the majority. This happens in among racial minorities as well. I did a book on race relations and found lots of African Americans regarding themselves as less because they've heard it so much from the white majority. And this happens, I think, with people in poverty. I remember Deborah Hall in Cleveland, a woman who got up at 2 or 3 in the morning to work in a bakery on an assembly line and a mind-numbing job. When I asked her why she was poor, she said, "Lazy. I'm lazy." I said, "You're lazy? You work harder than I do." But that's the way she perceived of herself. And that's a debilitating self-assessment because it saps you of the belief in yourself. And that belief is really essential to moving out of poverty. If you don't believe in yourself, you're not going to do your work well, you're not going to engage people in a confident manner, you're not going to get the education or the job training that you need. So all of that is part of the problem. But I do believe that the so-called safety net, which we hear about, is really tattered. It's really tattered. And that could be strengthened, and the levels of assistance could be raised so that fewer and fewer people are in poverty. You know, if you want to look at some statistical discussion of this, go on the Census Bureau website, census.gov, and look at find the section on what they call the supplemental poverty measure. You know, I told you that the way poverty line is calculated is outmoded. And for some years, they've been experimenting with more sophisticated methods, and they now have come up with a way of doing it. It's not the official poverty line, though. It has no impact on eligibility. So it's only for, you know, it's the sake of curiosity. But when they do that, first of all, the poverty rate goes up to 16%, because they put housing as a big component of it. And they also count as income government benefits, which are not counted in the official poverty rate. So the result of that, though, is it's very interesting. They go into government programs and they do a little calculation of what would happen to the poverty rate if those programs did not exist. So then I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they take away food stamps, and you see the poverty rate going up. They take away housing subsidies, you see the poverty rate going up. That kind of thing. And that tells you something about the impact of government programs and therefore the impact on increasing the scope of such programs to help people. So, but what I'm trying to argue in the book and when I speak to people is that lots of problems have to be addressed simultaneously. You can't just do one thing and expect that to carry over into addressing other issues. People need training in many respects. The best job training programs don't train people only in hard skills. They also train them in what they call soft skills. I've spent time at a job training program in DC run by a Catholic organization, So Others Might Eat, where some of the people coming in at the beginning could not have a conversation. They were so beaten down. You know, if you failed at school and you failed in relationships and you failed in job after job, you know, you don't suddenly believe you can succeed. And they'd look at the floor and mumble. And one of the classes was in office skills, learning computer techniques. It was run by a retired Marine Corps sergeant who showed them a lot of tough love. And he told me, I've structured it so everyone has at least one success every day. And he'd make them stand up in front of the trainees periodically and give little talks, extemporaneous or prepared. And he'd say, look at me, I can't hear you. And by the end of several months, the eyes came up off the floor, the voices gained clarity. People began to actually believe in themselves. And the Xerox Corporation, which does a lot of, they run mail rooms and copying rooms in Washington for lobbyists and law firms, hired a lot of people out of this program. And the human resources director said to me, I don't hire off the street anymore. I hire from that program because they deal with the whole person. They teach anger management. They teach punctuality. They teach work ethics. These are all very important. I talked to a lot of business people who said to me, you know, they complained, people don't show up at work. They don't call in if they're sick or they can't come. One of them was a guy I know who used to run Burger Kings. He would open one after another franchise for a larger owner. And it took him 6 months every time to get a core of workers who were dependable. So I mentioned this to Anne Brash, the woman who grew up in the middle class and fell into poverty, who had a very nice set of insights about poverty. She was quite perceptive. I said, you know, they say people aren't showing up. People aren't calling in if they're sick. She said, maybe they don't think they're important enough for anybody to care if they come to work. And I took this back to the Burger King manager, and it was like a light bulb going on over his head. He said, oh. He said, yeah, absolutely right. The fellow I mentioned in Cleveland who owns this small manufacturing company told me about a guy who didn't show up one day, and he called him up, and what happened, his car broke down. So the boss sent a worker to go pick him up and bring him in because he wanted him to understand that he was important. He was on the payroll because he needed him, and if he didn't come, he'd miss a production deadline or have to move people off that job to another. And so this whole, what one student who read the book and did a paper on it called The Internal Problems of the Poor, which I'd thought of, wish I had thought of that, but she thought of it. The internal problems of the poor need to be addressed as well. And they can be. And there are successes. And people do move up and out. Not many, but it does happen, which gives you hope that it can happen.
Finally, when those of us in this room finish working poor and we set it down on our coffee table, whatever, what do you want us to take away?
I'd like you to take away a non-ideological view of the problem, recognizing that real people don't fit neatly into either the box that the liberal Democrats create or the box that conservative Republicans create, but actually mix various factors. That the society as a whole has an interest, a self-interest, and also, I think, a moral commitment to find a way to make this ingenious private enterprise system that we have work better for everyone. It is ingenious. You know, I paraphrased, or I took Winston Churchill's line. You know, he made this famous statement, democracy is the worst system, except for all of the others that have been tried from time to time. And I plugged different words in, and I said, capitalism is the worst system, except for all of the others that have been tried from time to time. I lived for 4 years in a socialist country, the Soviet Union, so I've seen firsthand the terrible effects of that system. So I'm a big believer in the private market, but it needs to be tweaked, it needs to be managed, it needs to be regulated, and as a community, we do have, excuse me, the resources to do that and the mechanisms. I mean, I'm distressed at the anti-government attitudes. I was just in Waco, Texas last week and was told that there was a summer feeding program for kids that was started by two women who raised private funds because kids weren't in school because they weren't getting the free lunch there. And they refused to take government money, even though the U.S. Department of Agriculture has money for exactly for that program. But we don't want government money. And I guess my feeling was, well, you're sending money to Washington. You might as well get some back, you know. But this kind of, this sort of gut reaction against government, I think misses a feature of government that in America is very important, because we are an open society and we are a democracy, and the government is created by us, and therefore it can be a mechanism through which we, the citizens, mobilize our financial resources to do common good. I'm also aware that of all the pitfalls of that, and certainly having just written two books on civil liberties issues, I'm extremely sensitive to providing too much power to government. But I think that thinking creatively about the role, the interactions between government and the private sector, and about the non-ideological nature of poverty and the non-ideological approaches to poverty would be important things to take away.
David Shipler, thank you very much.
Thanks.
David Shipler spoke at the Fayetteville Public Library last month as the final event in the 2012 edition of One Book, One Community in Fayetteville and on the University of Arkansas campus. Our discussion was in front of the annual gathering of the groups, a collection of many members of several book clubs in the region. This is Ozarks at Large. Thank you.